In America, many people have a romantic idea of life in the countryside. Many living in towns dream of starting up their own farm, of living off the land. Few get round to putting their dreams into practice. This is perhaps just as well, as the life of a farmer is far from easy, as Jim Doherty discovered when he set out to combine being a writer with running a farm. Nevertheless, as he explains, he has no regrets and remains enthusiastic about his decision to change his way of life.
Mr. Doherty Builds His Dream Life by Jim Doherty. There are two things I have always wanted to do: write and live on a farm. Today, I'm doing both. I'm not in E.B. White's class as a writer or in my neighbor's league as a farmer, but I'm getting by. And after years of frustration with city and suburban living, my wife, Sandy, and I have finally found contentment here in the country. It's a self-reliant sort of life. We grow nearly all of our fruits and vegetables. Our hens keep us in eggs, with several dozen left over to sell each week. Our bees provide us with honey, and we cut enough wood to just about make it through the heating season. It's a satisfying life, too. In the summer, we canoe on the river, go picnicking in the woods, and take long bicycle rides. In the winter, we ski and skate. We get excited about sunsets. We love the smell of the earth warming and the sound of cattle lowing. We watch for hawks in the sky and deer in the cornfields. But the good life can get pretty tough. 3 weeks ago, when it was 30 below, we spent two miserable days hauling firewood up the river on a sled. 3 months from now, it will be 95 above, and we will be cultivating corn, weeding strawberries, and killing chickens. Recently, Sandy and I had to retile the back roof. Soon, Jim, 16, and Emily, 13, the youngest of our four children, will help me make some long overdue improvements on the outdoor toilet that supplements our indoor plumbing when we're working outside. Later this month, we'll spray the orchard, paint the barn, plant the garden, and clean the hen house before the new chicks arrive. In between such chores, I manage to spend 50 to 60 hours a week at the typewriter or doing reporting for the freelance articles I sell to magazines and newspapers. Sandy, meanwhile, pursues her own demanding schedule. Besides the usual household routine, she oversees the garden and beehives, bakes bread, cans and freezes, drives the kids to their music lessons, practices with them, takes organ lessons on her own, does research and typing for me, writes an article herself now and then, tends the flower beds, stacks a little wood, and delivers the eggs. There is, as the old saying goes, no rest for the wicked on a place like this, and not much for the virtuous either. None of us will ever forget our first winter. We were buried under 5 feet of snow from December through March. While one storm after another blasted huge drifts up against the house and barn, we kept warm inside, burning our own wood, eating our own apples, and loving every minute of it. When spring came, it brought two floods. First, the river overflowed, covering much of our land for weeks. Then the growing season began, swamping us under wave after wave of produce. Our freezer filled up with cherries, raspberries, strawberries, asparagus, peas, beans, and corn. Then our canned goods shelves and cupboards began to grow with preserves, tomato juice, grape juice, plums, jams, and jellies. Eventually, the basement floor disappeared under piles of potatoes, squash, and pumpkins, and the barn began to fill with apples and pears. It was amazing. The next year, we grew even more food and managed to get through the winter on firewood that was mostly from our own trees and only 100 gallons of heating oil. At that point, I began thinking seriously about quitting my job and starting to freelance. The timing was terrible. By then, Sean and Amy, our oldest girls, were attending expensive Ivy League schools, and we had only a few thousand dollars in the bank. Yet we kept coming back to the same question, will there ever be a better time? The answer decidedly was no, and so, with my employer's blessings and half a year's pay and accumulated benefits in my pocket, off I went. There have been a few anxious moments since then, but, on balance, things have gone much better than we had any right to expect. For various stories of mine, I've crawled into black bear dens for Sports Illustrated, hitched up dog sled racing teams for Smithsonian Magazine, checked out the Lake Champlain Monster for Science Digest, and canoed through the Boundary Waters Wilderness area of Minnesota for Destinations. I'm not making anywhere near as much money as I did when I was employed full-time, but now we don't need as much either. I generate enough income to handle our $600 a month mortgage payments, plus the usual expenses for a family like ours. That includes everything from music lessons and dental bills to car repairs and college costs. When it comes to insurance, we have a poor man's major medical policy. We have to pay the first $500 of any medical fees for each member of the family. It picks up 80% of the costs beyond that. Although we are stuck with paying minor expenses, our premium is low, only $560 a year, and we are covered against catastrophe. Aside from that, and the policy on our two cars at $400 a year, we have no other insurance. But we are setting aside $2,000 a year in an IRA. We've been able to make up the difference in income by cutting back without appreciably lowering our standard of living. We continue to dine out once or twice a month, but now we patronize local restaurants instead of more expensive places in the city. We still attend the opera and ballet in Milwaukee, but only a few times a year. We eat less meat, drink cheaper wine, and see fewer movies. Extravagant Christmases are a memory, and we combine vacations with story assignments. I suspect not everyone who loves the country would be happy living the way we do. It takes a couple of special qualities. One is a tolerance for solitude. Because we are so busy and on such a tight budget, we don't entertain much. During the growing season, there is no time for socializing anyway. Jim and Emily are involved in school activities, but they too spend most of their time at home. The other requirement is energy, a lot of it. The way to make self-sufficiency work on a small scale is to resist the temptation to buy a tractor and other expensive labor-saving devices. Instead, you do the work yourself. The only machinery we own, not counting the lawnmower, is a little 3-horsepower rotary cultivator and a 16-inch chainsaw. How much longer we'll have enough energy to stay on here is anybody's guess. Perhaps for quite a while, perhaps not. When the time comes, we'll leave with a feeling of sorrow, but also with a sense of pride at what we've been able to accomplish. We should make a fair profit on the sale of the place, too. We've invested about $35,000 of our own money in it, and we could just about double that if we sold today. But this is not a good time to sell. Once economic conditions improve, however, demand for farms like ours should be strong again. We didn't move here primarily to earn money, though. We came because we wanted to improve the quality of our lives. When I watch Emily collecting eggs in the evening, fishing with Jim on the river, or enjoying an old-fashioned picnic in the orchard with the entire family, I know we found just what we were looking for.